Hello and welcome to another in this series of talks about debate, argumentation, and persuasion. And today, I'll be flying solo throughout this entire presentation to talk to you about basic theoretical approaches to persuasion. It's very interesting to me that something as important as how we influence others and the process through which we use communication to get our way was so poorly theorized about in the years before the Second World War. Of course, throughout thousands of years of human history, persuasion and the strategic use of communication has been extremely important for human well-being, for the exercise of power, for creating order or disorder in our societies. And yet, there was very little comprehensive work done to try to come up with a theory of how the persuasion process works. In the years immediately following World War II, this really changed. There was an increased awareness of the importance of how populations are persuaded and how communication affects them. Of course, this was a legacy of the years leading up to World War II and World War II itself, where a number of incredible things happened that people wouldn't predict. Normally, rational, logical, and educated societies participated willingly or silently in many activities that were almost beyond comprehension. Our notion that we had created a global civilization was being questioned by certain events, that we could have the extermination of millions of Jews carried out by a highly educated and well-developed society, that we could have a broad social plan to strategically starve large portions of the Russian Kulak population as a tool for agricultural reorganization, that a highly civilized nation in the Far East could engage in an incident like the rape of Nanking, where countless innocent Chinese civilians were brutally killed, that in the United States, Japanese Americans could be rounded up not because of anything they had done, but because of their racial heritage and locked into internment camps during World War II. It was clear that the dynamics of persuasion and how it operates is extremely important for the well-being of humanity. And so following World War II, there was an increased interest in trying to discover what is the nature of this persuasion process and how does it operate. There were many attempts to examine this phenomena, to try to talk about and reason about the process of persuasion, what kind of communication strategies change minds and what kind don't, but very little of it was comprehensive, and almost none of it was empirical. In the years following World War II, and beginning in the 1950s, a number of such organized attempts were made to try to determine how this thing called persuasion works. What I want to do today is to talk to you about some of the early persuasion theories, not comprehensively, but just to give you an introduction to them. Because really, none of them were fully satisfactory, but they did lead to a modern theory of persuasion, which has been fairly useful. No theory can explain which communication variables will work with which audiences on which subjects all the time. But to the extent that we're able to develop a number of good guidelines of correspondence rules, what kind of things appear at the same time, some functional rules as to what kind of communication leads to what kind of result in what kind of situation, we're far better off in trying to understand how we personally can use communication and the skills of communication to try to influence people, change their minds, change their behavior, and change events. Let's start with the first of those basic theories, which was quite ambitious. It's called the Yale Attitude Change Approach. The Yale Attitude Change Approach. The names of the figures who are associated with this generally are Hovland, Janus, and Kelly. The Yale Attitude Change Approach decided that persuasion could be understood as an approach avoidance response. Those messages that we like, we approach, we become more involved with, we accept. Those that we don't like, we try to avoid. An attitude, they thought, was an approach avoidance response. If we have a positive attitude about something, we want more of it, we try to be associated. If we have a negative attitude about it, we try to stay away from it, we try to not be involved with it. Now, the big thing about the Yale attitude change approach is that they tried to use a comprehensive empirical framework for investigating these processes. It wasn't just enough to speculate, it had to be based in real human behavior in the finest social science tradition of America in the 1950s. They identified that there were four important processes at work in persuasion. And I think that this really has laid the groundwork for a lot of study of persuasion afterwards. Those processes are attention. Attention. You have to attend to the communication. Nothing happens unless you're listening. Second process is comprehension. You have to understand the message. It's hard to be persuaded by a message that we're not able to decode. The fourth process is the process of acceptance. We decide that a certain message is valid, it's worth listening to, it's worth remembering. In fact, we want to make that idea a part of our ideas and our beliefs. So the third process is acceptance. The fourth process is retention. Retention. We need to remember something and recall it for it to be useful for us through time. So there are four basic processes in persuasion: attention, comprehension, acceptance, and retention. And we notice that the earlier ones are essential if we are to get to the later processes themselves. Because if we don't attend to a message, we certainly can't comprehend it, accept it, or retain it. If we don't comprehend it, we're not likely to either accept or remember it, as other than just a bunch of gobbledygook. And unless we accept it and really try to integrate it into our cognitive framework, we're not likely to retain that message. So these four processes that the Yale Attitude Change Approach studied are sort of a step process that in order to get to the end, you have to go through the earlier processes. They also identified a bunch of variables. Now, with processes and with variables, they were ready to make some empirical investigations. Now, the variables that they indicated are pretty simple. Anyone who tries to even understand communication at the most basic level can identify these. There is a source for the message. There is the message itself. There is the audience for the message. And there is the audience response. Now, inside of each of these variables, they thought there were some that were more important than others. For example, in terms of source variables, there's the issue of expertise, of trustworthiness, of communication skill. For the message variable, there's the issue of how it's composed, how the message is ordered, whether it's one-sided or two-sided. A message, whether it tells you just what that one person wants you to believe or gives you more than one side of the story. If it tells you what to think very explicitly, it draws conclusions for you, or it allows you to draw your own conclusions, the use of evidence, all of these things would be message variables. Audience variables in the Yale Attitude Change Approach were thought to be basic factors about an individual that could influence their persuasibility. For example, their intelligence. If the argument and the idea is more complex, the audience's intelligence will have to be advanced in order to understand the idea. Self-esteem was thought to be a very important issue. If you have high self-esteem and believe in yourself, it is thought it would be harder to persuade you. Whereas if you are of low self-esteem, it might be somewhat easier to persuade you of things. Age, sex, financial position, cultural background, all of these things are also audience variables. Audience reaction variables were thought to be the issuance of counter-arguments by the audience. Does the audience hear the message and then do they react by saying, well, no, that's not true because of X, Y, and Z? participation of the audience, whether they ask questions, publicly acknowledge that they agree or disagree, or participate in any way with what's going on. So, four processes, four basic variables, lots of subgroups inside of the variables, plus a plethora of persuasive situations, and there was a lot of grist for the empirical research mill that was the Yale attitude change approach. And they indeed did establish a lot of experiments, and they came up with many different results. It's very interesting to look at some of those results because many of them still operate as truisms for things that you might want to keep in mind with persuasion, but there were a number of problems with the results that they got. There were contradictory findings. In some instances, more use of evidence helped persuade the audience. And in other instances, more use of evidence did not help persuade the audience. In some instances, more use of evidence actually turned the audience off, so they weren't as interested in the message. There were contradictions in findings, and it was very difficult to determine why these contradictory findings existed. So while lots of results were generated, they all seem to be particularized and often contradictory. There are very few broad concepts or conceptions that came out of the Yale attitude change approach. Very few success in finding a golden key that makes persuasion happening. Lots of variables, lots of results, not much theory. Another approach to try to understand what happens with persuasion was an approach that tried to look at the cognitive characteristics of individuals and try to look at the way in which our ideas and thoughts are organized to find there the key to persuasion. Now, previously, we've talked about the existence of attitudes, beliefs, values, motivations, and how these cognitive elements exist, the different roles that they play, and how they might be organized. There was an attempt on the part of some theorists who used the words like consistency, congruity, cognitive dissonance to try to understand persuasion based on the interreaction, interplay, and organization of these various cognitive elements. Heider, Osgood, Festinger, many others provided experiments and theoretical work that helped indicate that yes, these forms of organization were important, that different people might have different levels of consistency or congruity needs, that cognitive dissonance was more or less tolerable to some people, and that all these things were very important to attitude formation. But once again, no comprehensive explanation was given. One problem that kept cropping up was the difficulty in understanding how the nature of the source of the message interacted with all this. So there were some problems with a consistency, congruity approach as well. A third approach that emerged and did shed light on the subject, but as well was not comprehensive, was the group dynamics approach. The group dynamics approach, purported by scholars like Lewin and Ash. It was thought here that the individual is more than just an isolated, passive processor of arguments, that we are social beings, we're dependent on social interaction, and we're dependent on others and our relation to others for knowledge. A major factor that gets people to change their point of view is the discrepancy between what they believe and what other people believe, that people have social norms. There are group norms, and the existence and manipulation of group norms is very important for using communication to change people's mind. They thought that there was a pressure towards uniformity, a sense of a desire to conform. If everybody else believes something, we'd rather not be in disagreement with them. We won't fit in, we won't be accepted, and we have this craving, this yearning for social unity. Ash found that pressure toward uniformity occurred even with actual objective objects. He's the one who did the study about which of these two lines are longer and had a number of planted subjects point to the shorter line and say it was longer, and then there would be one real subject, and almost always they would agree. They would point to the shorter line as being longer because everyone before them had identified that, and they didn't want to be wrong. So the way to change people's minds, according to the group dynamics approach, was to change their position towards the norm, try to change the norm, reject the norm, adopt a new kind of social norm, and that was thought to be incredibly important. And of course it is. We are social beings. There is a pressure towards conformity, but it never seems absolute. It's almost constantly violated in some ways. In some ways, we want to go along with others, and in other ways, we really think for ourselves and reject social pressures. As well, there are a number of people who will disagree with things just because other people tend to agree with them. So the group dynamics approach and the social orientation that would affect persuasion was important, but it was clearly partial. Social interactions and group norms are important, but they're not all important. And once more, this study did not yield a comprehensive approach to how persuasion operates. The fourth attempt to come up with some kind of theory for persuasion was social learning theory. And it was really originated by a scholar by the name of Paul, who started to do experiments on this in the 1960s. The basic idea here is that there is a likelihood of a specific behavior, but it's governed by its consequences. And if there's a specific behavior that you want people to engage in, you reward them for it, and you try to model it, show that it works for others, and show that others benefit by it. We are social beings, but it's not just group conformity. We learn based on consequences to us and consequences to others what can be a good idea. Behavior, therefore, is largely determined by consequences. It sounds a lot like the kind of classical conditioning experiments that you would find in early psychology. We reward you for doing X, we punish you for doing Y, and guess what? People tend to do X. It's a sort of if-then relationship. If you do this, good things will happen. If you do this, bad things will happen. One of the most important things here is that people don't have to have it just happen to themselves, but they learn from experience, their own, as well as the experience of others. You can watch other people, good things happen to them, or bad things happen to them, and thus you are engaged in social learning. So basically, many of our attitudes, beliefs, and values are structured by our social experience and our learning, by our observing of consequences. Inside social learning theory, it was thought that there were basic techniques for how to influence someone using social learning theory. And the basic techniques were, first, direct reinforcement. You can reward people for doing things that you do want, or punish them for doing things that you don't want, and that will change both ideas and behavior. You can have extinction. You can desist from having any kind of positive or negative consequences. And if there's a behavior or a specific kind of idea which yields neither, through time, that behavior, that idea will become extinct. The third way that you can use social learning theory to persuade is by having people watch others. If people see that other people do well, this is sort of the case study. You can turn on TV all the time and see supposed social learning theory going on as people announce that since I bought so-and-so's magic real estate investment plan, I've become rich, I'm not smart or pretty, and you can do it too. That we can persuade people by showing them role models or examples, and then hopefully they will learn to follow that role model or that example. And the fourth way that you can use social learning theory is through the creation of rules or instructions and indicating that these rules and instructions are pathways to success or successful ways of doing things, in which case people will look at them and perhaps in interaction with the other ways that you can try to change people in this approach, decide that they will do that as well. There's no doubt that social learning goes on. We learn from things in our world constantly. We see what's around us, we observe, we learn, we try to do things that work, that are positive for us, we try to not do things that doesn't work. But a real problem with social learning theory is it's almost all happening inside the person and the person watching. Whereas persuasion is very much source-oriented. The source of the message is trying to strategically shape the communication to change the person's mind or change the person's behavior, or usually both. Social learning theory may explain how we learn, but doesn't indicate how we make our final decisions. Once again, relevant, illustrative, but not comprehensive, and not giving us the kind of predictive power that we would like in a theory of persuasion. The fifth approach, which came through in the late 60s and 1970s, is the information processing approach, most often associated with a scholar by the name of Weyer, W-Y-E-R. The thought here is that human beings are, in fact, rational information processors. And what we do is we process the information and determine how useful it is to us, and then we make decisions based on our manipulation of the information that we have received. It really seems to fit in with the persuasion situation where someone's giving you a communicative message, information and ideas, and then hoping that that will change your mind, change your behavior. The question for these theorists was, how does this process work? Initial experiments revealed that people tend to have pools of ideas that are related to certain concepts. That when we make a decision about what car to buy, for example, we have a pool of ideas about car choice. We consult that pool of ideas. I need something that I can afford. I need something that will be of high quality. I need something where that will be long-lasting. I need something that is stylish. I need something that has good reviews. I need something that other people will look upon with respect, a sort of a status symbol. There are many ideas that might be in that pool about buying cars. Everybody's pool of ideas or pool of arguments about buying that car may be somewhat different. So people will, in making decisions, look to that pool of ideas. The critical role of persuasion, therefore, is to take the pool of ideas that currently exists and either change ideas that are in that pool, suggest, for example, that BMWs are extremely cost-effective in the long run, even if they are expensive, or to add entirely new ideas to the pool, such as BMWs are the safest car on the road, and if you are going to have an accident, you want to have a BMW because you will be safe. This information may not be in the argument pool, and the persuader may want to put it there. Then the question is, how are these argument pools organized? Are they just, you know, random groups of arguments that people reach in and look at when they're trying to make a decision? How they are organized may be very important. And it was found that there are a couple of different ways that these things can be organized. For example, there is the additive approach to arguments. You merely count up the number of arguments. Here are the arguments in favor of buying a BMW. Here are the arguments against buying a BMW. And there are more arguments in favor than against, so I decide I will buy a BMW. You just count the arguments. The other approach is the averaging model. The averaging model, where you weigh the individual arguments that exist. And you decide, well, a BMW may be safe, and that's nice, but I cannot afford it. So the idea that it's not affordable is far more important than the fact that it has status or that it's safe. We simply can't afford those things. So generally they found that when people are making decisions important to themselves, they tend to use an averaging model. You weigh the different arguments in your argument pool, and that helps you to make a decision. And of course, this was very interesting. Studies showed that in many instances, this is exactly what happened. But it didn't provide a comprehensive explanation of what was going on, nor did it explain the role of source variables very well. Different sources tended to have different effects on the pool of arguments, and there was very little way to understand that. Well, That brings us to the final approach to argument, to persuasion, that I'd like to talk about today. And that's the theory that I'm currently buying into, and it's called the elaboration likelihood model of persuasion. The elaboration likelihood model of persuasion. Developed in the late 1980s by Petty and Cacioppo, this has emerged as both a comprehensive theory of persuasion, as well as one that helps explains the contradictions that have been found in previous studies. One of the powerful aspects of this particular theory is that it's able to go back and look at contradictory findings from the Yale attitude change approach and demonstrate through using this theory why those contradictory findings came about. And to explain this theory, I just want to use the walk through the basic concepts that the authors, Petty and Cacioppo, provide as a way to understand their theory. There are 8 central points in the elaboration likelihood model of persuasion, some of them fairly obvious but necessary, and others fairly complex. Let's journey through those 8, shall we? Number 1, people want to hold correct beliefs and attitudes. People want to hold correct beliefs and attitudes. They don't want to think things that are wrong. They don't want to think things that are stupid. They want to think things that are correct, that are useful. Everybody is motivated to have correct beliefs and attitudes, both correct in terms of how they relate to reality and how they relate to social norms. Second, motivation to elaborate. Motivation to elaborate or think. Motivation to think varies with individuals and situations. Some people don't like to think a lot about the messages they receive and the communications that they are engaged in. Others have a very high drive to think about things, to critically analyze ideas. But not only is it different between individuals, even for those individuals, it's different between situations. There are some situations where you will focus your critical cognitive energies on determining what's going on with this particular message and this idea. And there are other situations where you decide it's irrelevant, it's not important, and so you don't devote a lot of energy to it. People do tend to conserve their cognitive resources. You can't think in depth about everything that you encounter, every message that you receive, every argument, every persuasive appeal. You just can't do it. We conserve our cognitive resources and try to use them in areas where we think they are most important. So that's the second factor, that motivation to elaborate or think varies with individuals and situations. Third premise, they identified 3 variables that can impact the persuasion process. The 3 critical variables that can impact the persuasion process. And these are the moving parts that make this theory work. The first variable embodies persuasive arguments. Persuasive arguments. A message will contain persuasive arguments. These impact persuasion. They are reasons, evidence, logical connections, reasoned discourse that makes sense, that seems to be logical, that is accepted by the person as being a persuasive argument. If I enter the army, I will receive a bonus which I can use to go to college later. This would be a persuasive argument. The second variable are peripheral cues. Peripheral cues. Peripheral cues are in many instances non-content oriented, but nevertheless important. The most important peripheral cue is the source of the message or the speaker. There are other peripheral cues as well, images associated with the message, previous positions that that person has taken or advocated, and instances of mental shorthand. I just want to explain these different peripheral cues because I think they're very important. They can be different, but they all function in somewhat the same way. Let's talk about the source of the message. You can have the same message, But if a different source gives the message, it can have different kinds of outcomes. The source of the message, source attractiveness, source expertise, source celebrity, source character, all of these are important. And there's something that we evaluate outside of the kinds of arguments that they're making. Images, for example, are a kind of peripheral cue. I could be arguing that you should make a donation to the Feed the Children Foundation, but in doing so, I may show pictures of starving and needy children. These will have an impact on you outside of the logical arguments I'm making. The other two components here of peripheral cues, previous positions and mental shorthand, are very important. For many of us, if we have a previous position, I am opposed to police persons carrying guns, then if I'm offered an argument that indicates that they need guns, I will tend not to, in some instances, critically analyze it because I've already decided I don't like police with guns. And so that's the way it goes. We also have a certain mental shorthand that we use. Remember, we don't have time to think about everything. We have some basic conclusions, and we accept that. For example, you might have a bit of mental shorthand that says, more money for me is good. More money for me is good. And then when someone asks me, you know, would you like more money, I don't have to make the decision. You know, is money for me really something I want? It's a mental shorthand. People may use mental shorthands in evaluating political candidates. Don't want a woman in that elected office. Nuh-uh, no Republicans for me. Nope, those Tories have got to go. You know, you may use mental shorthand, and these are all peripheral cues. The third variable here in the elaboration likelihood model, variables that can impact persuasion, is the extent and direction of elaboration. The extent and direction of elaboration. Now, by elaboration, I mean thinking. Thinking. How much are you willing to think about the message that's being presented? Well, that's the extent of elaboration. Sometimes you decide that you will think a lot about a message, and you decide that you want to devote some attention to understanding it, to critiquing it, to evaluating it. So there's the extent of elaboration. That's very important, to make your audience think. But there's also the direction of elaboration, the way in which your audience thinks about the messages that you are providing. Now, a couple of different directions of elaboration are biased versus objective elaboration. Biased versus objective elaboration. In biased elaboration, you take a current view that you have. Say, someone from a political party other than my own is trying to persuade me to vote for their party. And if I'm just going to engage in biased elaboration, I'll just think about all the reasons I don't particularly like their political party. Boom. That's it. Now, if I'm engaging in objective elaboration, I'll think about, here's the reasons their party is bad, here's the reasons their party is good, and I'll also factor into it what the other parties I might vote for are like, whether they're better, and I would make a very objective decision. Based on all the arguments I can think about, what should I do? That's very much more of a persuasive argument approach than the approach that just says, well, what do I already believe? I already believe this. It's not fitting in with what they're saying, so I reject it. That's very much a peripheral cue. We're using a kind of mental shorthand when we're engaged in biased elaboration. So that's the third critical point here, that there are three variables that can impact persuasion: persuasive arguments, peripheral cues, and the extent and direction of elaboration. This is a powerful theory, and I hope that you'll take the time to think through some of the factors that are at work here. Let's talk about the fourth major point in understanding this theory: persuasive arguments. We call the use of persuasive arguments the central route for persuasion. The central route for persuasion. That people critically analyze the persuasive arguments, and when they do that, they are utilizing what we call the central route. Now, the things that cause people to utilize this central route, this logical, reasoned evaluation of your communication, are things like personal relevance. If things are really personally relevant to us, we think about them closely and carefully before we decide what to do. New information is also a way in which we can facilitate the use of the central route. Here is some new information that you should integrate into your cognitive structures. Comprehension and understanding is extremely important when you're using persuasive arguments, this central route. If they don't understand them and comprehend them, it's not going to work at all. Also, with persuasive argument approach, this central route, you try to encourage objective elaboration. You want to get them to think about all the different ideas, pro and con, so that they can make a logical, reasoned decision. You want your audience to be on the central route when your arguments are strong, your logic is excellent, when they are motivated, when there is personal relevance, when you can provide new information. So that's that part. Part number four, the persuasive argument part, the central route. Point number five in understanding this theory is a discussion of peripheral cues. Peripheral cues. This is the peripheral route. This is the peripheral route. We don't always make our decisions based on logic and reasoning. In many instances, we make them based on many other factors. We are making these decisions on the peripheral route. We remember what those peripheral cues are: source focus, intangibles, associations, images, symbols, pictures of the starving children with an attractive movie star telling you to give money, and that's the basis of the argument. That's a peripheral route appeal. If someone comes up to you and say, if a competing advocate says, well, if you give so much money, it will have so much results, we will feed X number of children, they will benefit in these ways, otherwise they will not, they will suffer, that's mostly a central route appeal. When people are confused, when they have a lack of comprehension and understanding, they tend to default to this peripheral route. When they are on this peripheral route, they tend to engage in biased elaboration. Biased elaboration. They only think of those ideas that support what they already believe. Remember that mental shorthand, previous positions, these are all powerful forces on the peripheral route. You can say, I don't need to think about it. My mind is made up. Bang. There we are on the peripheral route. Point number six, the role of elaboration in this persuasion process. Well, the extent of elaboration is really affected by motivation. You're not going to think about something in great detail unless you're motivated to do so. If you feel that something is very important to you, that it's essential, then you will think about it. If it's not important to you, you won't. Biased elaboration, for example, tends to occur at levels of low motivation. It's not difficult for you to think about what you already believe. It's not difficult for you to retrieve that mental shorthand, those previous associations. Oh yeah, I never believed Tories. Oh yeah, you know, New Labor wants to take all my money. So that you have these basic bits of mental shorthand that you use, that's biased elaboration. And it takes low motivation. It's easy for you. Objective elaboration, on the other hand, takes very high motivation to go through all the argument pools that you have in your brain and to identify the arguments in favor of one side and then the arguments in favor of the other side, as well as opposing arguments to both sides, and then weigh them and decide which is best, a sort of averaging model that Wire talked about. That takes a lot of motivation to do that. Number seven, the central route tends to trade off with the peripheral route. Now we've seen the central route are using the arguments and the ideas, the reasoning, the logic, the evidence. The peripheral route is using the source, the intangibles, the associations, the mental shorthand. Generally, we decide which of these routes we will choose. We trade-off. We do not evaluate everything based on the central root. Some things we don't need to. I don't like anchovies on my pizza. That's all there is to it. I consult my mental shorthand. When I'm offered anchovies, I say no, because it's not that important. If I was told that anchovies held the key to preventing cancer, and I was concerned that I was in an age and in a demographic area and in a polluted zone that I might get cancer, then I might reconsider this based on personal relevance. So anchovies are much more important than just a salty taste. They can have a big impact on my personal health. The central root trades off with the peripheral root. Personal relevance, new information, tends to trigger the central root. Source focus, use of intangibles, images, and confusion or lack of comprehension can trigger the peripheral root. Thus, the secret of this approach is that you have to decide which root you want your audience to take in processing your persuasive message. Then, when you have them on that route for processing, you need to do what is necessary and successful on that particular information processing route to get the kind of results you want. Final point, number 8. Central root persuasion is different than peripheral root persuasion. Central root persuasion is different. The first important difference is that central root persuasion is much harder to achieve. It's much harder to achieve. You have to motivate the audience. You have to give them information. You have to create personal relevance. You have to make them think that it's really important. Then they might use the central root. But that can be difficult to do. People who are secure or well off or apathetic, like most of the consuming public in the United States, it's very hard to get them involved in central root persuasion. But if you do, if you are able to get them on the central root, then the central root tends to be more persistent. Attitude change. When you change people's minds on the central root, they tend to stay changed. They tend to stay changed longer. The other thing about changing on the central root is that it leads to behavior. It's more likely to lead to behavior. Oh, it's harder to accomplish. But once you accomplish it, people will actually take their beliefs and act on it if they've been influenced by the central root. And finally, the central root offers more resistance to counter persuasion attempts. The central root processing has taken arguments and ideas and evidence and integrated it into their cognitive structure. It makes it more difficult for them to be re-persuaded by someone else. On the other hand, in a peripheral root approach, if you're trying to decide which exercise machine to buy to give you those rock-hard abdominal muscles that you really need, if one is, you know, endorsed by one sports star, that looks good, but another one might be endorsed by another sports star, and it's pretty easy to overcome that first bit of peripheral root persuasion because it's all about the source. But if you have specific arguments, if you're on the central root, this machine is better for the following 3 logical and evidenced reasons, it's much easier for you to resist later persuasive attempts. The story of the 20th century has been the story of moving from a ignorance and rejection of the importance of persuasion theory to concerted and organized attempts to determine how the process of persuasion works. We had a number of persuasive theories that developed. None were comprehensive, but all contributed important concepts to the eventual decision that the elaboration likelihood model seems to be the model that best predicts, that best understands, and that can best control how persuasion works in our modern society. Is it the ultimate theory? No, of course not. There will always be new ideas and new refinements, but it is a major breakthrough, and it's the kind of thing that you can use in everyday life to improve your success at persuasion. Now, in a later address, I'll be talking about how to use these concepts to analyze audiences and get the results you wish. But for now, that's enough about theories of persuasion. Thanks a lot for tuning in, and I'll see you in our next installment.